This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. State Senator Jason Barrickman of Bloomington isn't celebrating much over the on-time delivery of a state budget this year.
I don't think this is a pat-yourself-on-the-back moment. I think it's a recognition of this is what we're supposed to do.
Lawmakers are still mindful of voter outrage over the last several years of budget standoff. Eric Stock has more with Senator Barrickman. The summit with North Korea is underway. You'll find out from an ISU expert on East Asian politics about what to watch for. And during an edition of the GLT Datebook, hear about Relay for Life. Organizers are trying to keep the cancer fundraiser the second largest in the state. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Monday, June 11th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un are just hours away from their historic summit in Singapore. But just how historic is it, really? GLT's Ryan Denham spoke with T.Y. Wang from the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University. The expert on East Asian politics shares what he'll be watching for in this unprecedented summit.
Putting to the historical perspective, there are some similar summits that are between foes throughout the histories. And some of those high-level summits being considered as successful, and some are not as successful, or some has been considered successful at the time, and then later on, analysts have different assessments. For instance, the British Prime Minister's Chamberlain's summit was Adolf Hitler in 1938, was coined, was the very concept of appeasement. The Yalta Conference between U.S. President Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet Union's Joseph Stalin. It was considered a very successful one at the time, but later on, analysts believe that the United States and UK has conceded too much, which led to the Cold War. Others have been considered as important ones, such as President Nixon's visit to China, met with Chairman Mao, and which opened up the China and led to the China today.
How are we going to know if this was successful, this summit?
With regard to Trump and Kim's summit tomorrow, and this will be assessed, how it will be assessed is still yet to be determined. And I think that what analysts will, in my view, that will look at is whether Trump can make a deal and secure a deal that can denuclearize North Korea, and also is whether Kim can secure a deal that can guarantee North Korea's security and economic prosperity, and most importantly, is whether this agreement will lead to a diminishing influences or enhance U.S. influence in East Asia. So these are the questions, in my view, that will be carefully analyzed by the in the future.
So you've talked about how you think an event like this might be judged moving into the future, but what do you think will actually happen?
First of all, I think it's always a good idea for Trump and Kim to sit down to have a conversation, because just a few months ago, the both leaders are trading personal insults and comparing who's the nuclear button is bigger. And as we know, in a nuclear war, the destruction is total and comprehensive. So I think this is a very good idea for the leaders of both countries to sit down and have a civilized conversation. That said, many experts on the country, on the issue, have long argued that the United States and North Korea have a very different definition of denuclearization. The popular notion of denuclearization in the United States is to have a comprehensive, verifiable, and irreversible disarmament of a nuclear capability and its associated infrastructure of North Korea. But based upon what we have seen so far, North Korea seems to refer to American strategic capability of striking North Korea with nuclear weapons, and also American's nuclear umbrella that covers Japan and South Korea. So this different definition, a different understanding of what denuclearization actually means makes this meeting somewhat uncertain. The best possible outcome, in my view, is that if we can have a general outline of an agreement that identify denuclearization as the end goal, that would be considered as important. And for the United States, I think so the top priority is to see whether we can codify some suspension of North Korea's nuclear and missile flight test, and down the road, and see whether that both sides can agree on an arrangement that can verify the denuclearization process, and possibly to bring in the international organizations such as the International Atomic Energy Agency into the process. And that will be something that to be considered. But I think the bottom line is that this has to be considered as a process, as the South Korean President Moon stated today, is that this probably take years to be completed.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm in studio with T.Y. Wang, the chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University, talking about Tuesday's summit between the United States and North Korea. Is this all going to be focused on denuclearization? Are there any human rights implications that are going to be on the table as these two leaders sit across from one another? North Korea is a famously closed-off nation.
Right now, as we understand it, is that the human rights issue is not on the table. But it will not will be conducive to the improvement of North Korea's human rights if the North Korea's economic development can be improved, economic situation can be improved. But at this moment, I believe that the Trump administration is to focus on the denuclearization and so that it will not be diverted its attention from this very important goal.
So why is this being held in Singapore? How did they decide on that location?
Singapore is, if you all think consider, is that this is probably a right choice. There are other places that has been considered, but if you look at the overall picture, you see that Singapore is quite experienced in holding high-level meetings, and Shangri-La Security Dialogue or APAC meetings that have been held over there. So its diplomatic corps and its security and intelligence apparatus are very experienced. And also, Singapore is a city-state. Although it's a small city-state, it's a hotel complex. It has great facilities. It's a safe place, and it's a convenient place. And plus, it has been perceived as politically neutral. It has a diplomatic relations with both United States and North Korea. And in prior to 2016, North Korean citizens can visit Singapore visa-free. And besides, and Singapore is probably the closest allies in South Asia with the United States. So all things considered, Singapore becomes a right choice.
What do you think of China's role in all this? They've historically been sort of a middleman between the world and North Korea, but now Trump and Kim Jong-un seemingly don't need a middleman. So how does China factor in here?
The Chinese leaders actually share some common interest with the United States with regard to North Korea, because a unstable North Korea is likely to flood in China, northern China, with hundreds of thousands refugees. And besides, unstable North Korea is likely to for China to lose a buffer between South Korea, which is supported by the United States, and China. So it is to the interest of China to see a stable, possibly denuclearized North Korea. But Chinese leaders see a different way to achieve that objective. That is, for Chinese leader, they believe that the least costly options is to assist North Korea from its isolation. And if they can be translate that into a normal international actors, then that will make the sanction, for instance, imposed on North Korea less likely. But of course, and due to the strategic rivalry between China and the United States, and China probably has even a long-term goal, that is to decouple United States from the East Asia, especially with regard to the strategic rivalry in the South China Sea. As we know that China has expanded its presence, its special military presence in the South China Sea, and the United States and tried to assert its freedom of navigation and conduct the freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. If the United States can reduce its military presence, and that will be to China's strategic interest in the region. So that's why some analysts believe that China in this process is manipulating the North Korea. And so would like to use this as a mechanism to achieve a long-term objective. Because if there, for instance, if there is a peace treaty signed between North and South Korea, and then a host of questions will be raised. For instance, should the United States continue to station its troops in the Korea Peninsula? And should the United States continue to deploy the missile defense system? So all these questions will be raised. Then what's the relationship between the United States and South Korea and Japan? So these questions will be raised.
At the beginning of our conversation, you referenced President Nixon's trip to China as one parallel in history to this moment. Do you see a possibility of 50 years from now that North Korea is as open to the world as China is today?
After President Nixon's visit to China in 1972, Chinese leader adopted the market economy and therefore further opened up in China. And as a result, and that leads to what China is today. So it is likely and it's possible to see that North Korea can do the same thing if they are willing to open up its economy and adopt this kind of reform. So it is possible, I mean, 50 years from now, that I will see a completely different North Korea. And again, this will be depending upon the leader's choice.
That's T.Y. Wang, chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University. I'm Ryan Denham.
The summit begins at 9 a.m. Tuesday in Singapore. That's 8 p.m. tonight in Illinois. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the University of Illinois system. Three universities, Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield, one system and a $14 billion economic impact from students, alumni, and employees statewide. Altogether extraordinary. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, find out what Relay for Life organizers are doing to keep the cancer fundraiser the second largest in the state. Charlie Schlenker has the interview during an edition of GLT's Datebook. I'm Mike McCurdy. State Senator Jason Barrickman has been in Springfield for several years now, but this is the first time he's voted for a successful budget that passed on time. GLT's Eric Stock takes the temperature in the General Assembly with Barrickman.
I think the public expects us to work together. You know, they recognize that we're going to have some philosophical differences, but they've made their choices in elections, and they expect us to work together to do our jobs. And so I don't think this is a pat yourself on the back moment. I think it's a recognition of this is what we're supposed to do. I'm pleased that we came together in an agreement. You know, this is a full year bipartisan budget. I think it's manageable by the governor. I'll tell you, for me, the frustrating component is the things that have not been addressed by our state. So, you know, adopting a full year budget, that's very meaningful. That's a check that off the to-do list. But we all know that there's a laundry list of things that we must do if we're going to turn our state around and see some progress in our state, those are things like reforming our economy so that our economy grows, adopting some pro-growth reforms. That includes addressing our unfunded pension liabilities. It includes addressing our soaring liabilities in programs like Medicaid. And those are issues which aren't fixed, let's say, by the adoption of the budget. They're issues that for which there's not an agreement among the parties on how to address them. And those are issues that I think are going to be a big part of what the November election cycle is all about.
And we'll get to November in just a moment. But lastly, on the budget, how much do you feel that the tax increase last year, which generated about $5 billion, helped in getting this resolution this year? Because it seems in the past there's been so much imbalance between revenue coming in and expenses going out.
Look, I always thought that the tax, not doing a tax increase before you implement reforms, forces those in the legislature to make the tough reform-minded decisions before you put more money in the pot. So I still think that we got that backwards. That's why I didn't support that tax increase before. Now, absolutely, I think it need not be stated that if there's more money in the pot, it's easier to come to agreement on how to spend it. The heartburn comes from the fact that by making things easier in how to spend it, it also makes it more difficult in resolving the more challenging issues, again, like Medicaid reform, pension reform, and the other things that our state needs to address if we're going to see our economy boom and our overall balance sheet and fiscal situation improve itself.
And then, as you mentioned, in November, when a lot of these other issues will be decided after the election, how much was the election overshadowing this, or was it just a matter of the budget was just so all-consuming that that was all that could get accomplished before then?
No, I think that the fact that every member of the Illinois House of Representatives has their name on the ballot this November. Bruce Rauner has his name on the ballot this November. I've got my name on the ballot this November. The fact that people are up for an election and that the electorate is woefully frustrated with, you know, how we're operating together, I think that electoral pressure or the anticipation of electoral pressure put pressure on both sides to conduct themselves in a reasonable manner where they worked with the other side, they compromised, and came together on an agreement. I think both sides recognized the risk of being portrayed by the electorate as an obstructionist. And so, you know, kudos to the public for standing up for what they think is important.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock, joined by State Senator Jason Berrickman. Shifting to some other political news, in a sense, more and more pressure regarding Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan, the latest coming from Pat Quinn, a former governor, who is asking Madigan to step down as chairman of the Democratic Party. This regarding the sexual harassment scandal that has unfolded in his office over the last several months. Has Madigan handled this appropriately? In your view, has he gone far enough?
Well, you know, so everyone around Madigan, whether it's the elected officers, office holders who he put on his leadership team, to the top lobbyists and campaign workers who had his trust, to now, in the last day or so, his longtime chief of staff. All these people are being accused of sexual harassment and harassing employees and others. And what's clear to me is that there's a cultural problem that exists within our state government. And look, I don't think that all the stories, I think there's more stories that'll come out. I don't think that all the stories are going to be about just those people close to Madigan. although admittedly much of the stories right now are. But I don't think it's limited to his caucus. However, I think as Democrats they've got a real problem here.
Should he step down as party chairman, and should the rest of the party leadership force that?
Well, it's not my call, right? I mean, I'm a Republican in this. You know, the call here is for Illinois Democrats to have a gut check moment as to whether they are willing to go it alone. You know, Mike Madigan has been the godfather of probably more political careers and more successful lobbyists and more successful people than possibly anyone else in Illinois political history. So they have to look at that and question whether their loyalty to him should exceed or outweigh the fact that he is the head of the helm of a state that is in fiscal dire straits, and he's the head of the helm of an organization, specifically, you know, what's happened in his Democratic Machine organization that is clearly infected with a culture that is unacceptable in the world that we live in today.
House Republican candidates have been running against Madigan publicly for years with not a tremendous amount of success. How much will this become a campaign issue in November?
Well, I think it already was a campaign issue. I think that for every Republican legislative candidate, one of the questions of the local campaign to their Democratic opponent is whether or not that Democrat would support Madigan in a vote for Speaker. I think this is going to be an issue this fall. I think that the Me Too campaign and the existence of a culture of harassment inside Madigan's organization will lead to, you know, more political fodder and opposition to him. But ultimately, I think the public wants to see our state make progress on issues that we have been beating like a dead horse for years. We have a state that we should be proud of. We have a state that has great assets and great people, and we are plagued by a government that's not serving us. And he, through this process, he has had an iron tight grip on what does and does not happen out of our government. So for those who are frustrated with it, their remedy is to elect people to office who pledge not to vote for Mike Madigan as Speaker. Easy one for me to take.
GLT's Eric Stock spoke with GOP State Senator Jason Berrickman of Bloomington, and you heard it on Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A couple of high-profile Democrats fell last week as part of the ongoing Me Too cultural moment in Springfield. Deputy Majority Leader Liu Lang resigned his leadership position but remains in office after a lobbyist accused him of sexual harassment. And House Speaker Mike Madigan's longtime right-hand man, Tim Mapes, is out after being accused of harassment by someone working for him. The Illinois Politics Roundtable takes a swing at this issue. Sean Crawford moderates with IPR's Brian Mackey, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and Amanda Vinicky of Public Television's Chicago Tonight.
You know, I want to be very clear here on what that is, because I had seen somewhere this described as a, quote, sex scandal. It is most certainly not that. Really, I think what one could characterize it as was bullying at the top. Harassment, yes. Sometimes comments that could be characterized as sexual harassment, but really what it was is Tim Mapes being accused of using his role is truly what I think you could assess, I've described as the most powerful unelected figure in Illinois politics, in using that to foster a culture of abuse and of harassment, and or at least allowing that to continue, but him playing a role in that. So in particular, you had a woman, Sherry Garrett, who works for the clerk's office, come to Chicago and announce at a news conference a series of allegations. For example, that you had a former legislator Ken Duncan, perhaps we can talk about that later, but saying to her and to another woman, I want to take both of you home and see which of you is naughtiest. And when that was reported to Mapes, he didn't want to do anything about it. He hoped that that would blow over. Another comment in which supposedly he said to Ms. Garrett, comments basically inferring that she was, you know, cheating on her husband, but then saying, no, that's not at all what I was intending, and a very uncomfortable conversation for any sort of boss to have with a leader. And then further, his really making fun of the sexual harassment training, that was, she said, what made her come forward, because, of course, that was a comment that Mapes is alleged to have made after this Me Too movement was full throttle and after his boss, Speaker Michael Madigan, had said he was taking this issue very seriously and doing all he could to change the culture. So it really is remarkable how swift this movement has gained steam and how quickly it has led to the fall of people that were really thought of as untouchable in the State House.
And swift action, certainly, because the speaker was very quick to, just as he was with Liu Lang, to issue a statement. And I believe Tim Mapes officially resigned from the position, but it sounds as though that was at Madigan's request from everything we've heard. Brian, have we heard from Tim Mapes? Have we heard any more from the speaker? What's been the response?
We heard the speaker say that day that Mapes resigned at his direction. So, but after that, I have not heard from Mapes, and I have not we have not heard anything else from the speaker until actually Friday morning. It's worth noting here, Mapes's power was not just that he was Speaker Madigan's chief of staff; he was also the executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois. So, sort of the person who makes sure that the gears are running smoothly, makes the trains run on time. Pick your metaphor there. And he resigned from both positions at the speaker's direction. And we learned Friday morning that the speaker is appointing all 18 Democratic committee women. And in the Democratic Party, each of the 18 congressional districts has a committee man and a committee woman. Those 18 women are going to jointly be a search committee to search for a new executive director of the Democratic Party of Illinois. In terms of the reaction and the overall charges here, I want to say I'm glad Amanda made the point that this is more a bullying scandal and not a, you know, quote unquote sex scandal. And I think that we have seen other people in the speaker's organization accused of being autocratic and trying to push people around, even pushing elected officials around, which kind of turns things on its head. You're not, you know, you're used to, you might expect to hear that Senator so-and-so is really tough on his staff or something like that. You're not used to hearing that the staff is tough on the politicians. But in fact, we have heard reports over the years that that's the way the speaker's organization runs. And that's one of the reasons that they've been successful, is they have this very disciplined, very hard-charging approach. The question is, can you translate that approach into 2018, where we're supposed to have more respectful workplace attitudes, and, you know, saying the wrong thing has led to a lot of bad consequences for people and public approbation and those sorts of things.
And Charlie, let me get your thoughts on this, on just what you've heard and what you've read this week.
Well, I think what Brian said is correct, that it's an entirely different environment. You have to look at Michael Madigan's organization and realize that it came to maturity, if you will, 35, 40 years ago, at a time when the Cook County Democratic Organization was run like a military machine. And as a matter of fact, the ward committeeman in Chicago was more powerful than the alderman. And the alderman, in essence, served at the pleasure of the ward committeeman. Everyone served at the pleasure of Mayor Daley. And so it was a very military-like operation. And people making comments that today would be seen as improper was not all that rare. And people bullying in the same sense that a drill sergeant would bully people in boot camp, that occurred all the time. But as Brian said, we have a different environment now. There's got to be a greater, sensitivity to other people's feelings in positions of power. And that's what I think led to the downfall of Tim Mapes. As Amanda said, he wasn't accused of groping anybody or anything like that. He was basically, he didn't treat other people with enough respect in their view.
Well, these allegations are not, they don't involve Madigan doing anything wrong per se. There's nothing, no allegation against him specifically, but it is certainly aimed more at his inner circle with Tim Mapes. And Amanda, when we think back of Michael Madigan, we talk about the, you know, the strategist. He's, you know, he's a genius when it comes to political strategy and keeps people in line. And, you know, he makes sure that, you know, the House is able to function the way he wants it to. At the same time, what Charlie was talking about, running it like a military machine, kind of following up on the way Chicago had been run. Are those days over? Is that, you know, is that what we really can get from this?
You know, I think that there are a lot of questions going forward as to what this will mean for Madigan. It is clear that in some fashion, those days are over. Culture is typically somewhat slow to change, but we are seeing, like I just said, this movement really gain traction at an incredible pace. What this means for Madigan in terms of, yes, there is a power vacuum, and it's not just with Mapes. He's also seeing, we just saw Deputy Majority Leader Liu Lang resign from that leadership post. Barbara Flynn Curry, who has been the, you know, sort of number two legislator within House Democrats, she will be retiring. You had State Representative Dan Burke lose his primary election. Those are three longtime, you know, Democratic loyalists. So there's just, on a practical level, how are things going to work? Who is Madigan going to have that knows as much as Mapes knew in order to really have the House function? Then there are the questions in terms of what this means for Madigan going forward. Is this some sort of, you know, inside takedown, perhaps a part of the Democratic Party that wants change and is going after him? It does not appear as if this is some sort of, you know, we see a lot of opposition research, or this isn't coming from Bruce Rauner. You're seeing Democrats from within ally and come forward and go public. Will they insist on change? We are seeing, as Brian said, for example, you've had several, now there will be the women of the Democratic Party State Central Committee help to choose its new executive director. There have been a series of task forces. There are a multitude, it seems, almost, of investigations and court cases. Will that force change? I think part of that is going to be what else comes out. I suspect that the allegations made by Sherry Garrett are not going to be the end of this. And in fact, the woman who sort of first really got this ball rolling, Elena Hampton, who's pursuing a federal court case against Madigan's political organizations, has issued public calls to keep up the momentum for more women to speak out, because she says there's strength and protection in numbers.
And it does seem, Brian, real quick, it does seem as though, you know, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but a theme that keeps coming up in some of these is that these women have felt as though that their complaints have not been addressed, that they have brought these complaints up and nothing has happened. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly heard that from Ms. Garrett. She said that, as Amanda pointed out, when she brought the complaint about former state representative Ken Duncan forward, she said her impression was that, or what she says that Mapes said to her is this will blow over, and her impression was he wanted it swept under the rug, but that was eventually dealt with by other people in her organization. And that certainly was the concern that Elena Hampton had, is that she had, you know, she had this concern about the appearance of how she left the organization. That's why she wrote the letter to the speaker. She said she felt blackballed and retaliated against, that she couldn't get, you know, advance her career as a political staffer because of she had come forward with this.
IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey is part of the Illinois Politics Roundtable, along with Amanda Venicky of Chicago Public TV, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and moderator Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois could set a record this year. The state will host what could be the most expensive race for governor in U.S. history. The huge increase in campaign spending raises a lot of questions about the rise of big money in politics. Over the next few months, Illinois Issues will examine that impact. Mary Hansen has the first installment of the series, Money Machines.
State Representative David Harris is retiring this year, and part of the reason is money. He's represented Arlington Heights and Mount Prospect for two separate stints, stretching back to 1983.
Back then, I think the primary campaign cost me $14,000. Now, I would think it would be probably 100 times that.
Harris is a Republican and a fiscal conservative. Because of that, he went against his party last year and voted to end the budget stalemate, supporting a spending plan and a tax increase to pay for it.
I could have run again, but I then would have had to go through 4 months of a lot of fundraising because the right wing of my party has said, you know, you voted for that tax increase and that was just the wrong thing to do, and we will spend any amount of money to beat you.
Any amount of money now feels possible in Illinois politics. Campaign spending has skyrocketed, fueled by donors who are able to give huge amounts. An analysis of data from the nonpartisan site followthemoney.org shows that back in the 2006 legislative and statewide races, Illinois candidates raised a combined $43 million. And most of that money came from
the traditional sources of big money, which tend to be interest groups, manufacturers, chamber of commerce, trade unions, trial lawyers.
That's Kent Redfield, a retired political scientist from the University of Illinois Springfield. Fast forward to the 2014 elections, campaign fundraising had more than tripled. A good chunk of the cash, around 40%, came from just a handful of big donors.
So you've got this dramatic increase in how much money is coming into the system that is as a result of the actions of a small number of individuals.
This year, in the race for governor between a billionaire and near billionaire, campaign contributions from the candidates alone already total more than $150 million. In other words, J.B. Pritzker and Bruce Rauner have individually given more money than was raised on all statewide and legislative races in 2014. Ian Vandwalker is senior counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice. He says Illinois politicians are copying tactics that were tested at the federal level after the Citizens United decision.
It's a trend that is still developing, and it seems like just in terms of dollar amounts, Illinois is definitely on the forefront.
That court decision opened the door to individuals, corporations, and unions making unlimited contributions to political campaigns. He says what that amounts to is
kind of arms race mentality, where every candidate wants to have the biggest war chest that they can, and they know that the most efficient way to do that is to make phone calls to extremely rich donors.
On the Republican side, that includes the richest man in Illinois, Ken Griffin, and conservative donor Richard Uihlein, as well as Rauner. For Democrats, that is gubernatorial nominee and Hyatt hotelier J.B. Pritzker, who is cutting checks to state and county party organizations in an effort to shore up the Democratic majority in the legislature. What effect all that money has on politics is up for debate. Some, like GOP Representative David Harris, who is leaving the legislature after this year, says it's driving division.
We've always had divisions within our country, but I think this influence of individuals who can drive dollars based on ideology widens the divide and makes both sides more polarized.
But others argue, while yes, money is an operating force in politics, it's not the operating force. Tom Bowen is a Democratic strategist and fundraiser.
Does money in politics matter? Well, yeah, it changes the debate. It can for sure have consequences. But if you're right with the voters and you tell them that and you find your way to get, you know, your message out to them, you're going to be fine.
It's worth noting that a lot of that money in politics is spent getting a candidate's message out. I'm Mary Hansen.
Throughout this election season, we'll explore other ways money is affecting politics in the series Money Machines. Next time, find out how money filters down to legislative races, affecting not just who wins, but who even decides to run. You're listening to Sound Ideas. You can listen to Sound Ideas with your smart speaker. With Google Home, just say, "Okay, Google, play GLT's Sound Ideas podcast," or listen to all GLT has to offer with Amazon Echo. Just ask Alexa to play NPR. Find all of the individual stories and interviews on today's Sound Ideas at WGLT.org. We live our lives online. That's why GLT is there. We put a lot of effort into Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and WGLT.org.
But don't take our word for it. Listen to the words of the judges who recognized GLT with an Illinois Associated Press Award for Best Digital Presence.
Great photos.
It's a one-stop shop.
Great Facebook interaction. Through the
airwaves. On air and online, we are GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas, a major effort to fund cancer research and support for those undergoing cancer treatment is coming up in McLean County. The annual Relay for Life is June 22nd and 23rd. And for the GLT Datebook, Charlie Schlenker talks with coordinator Kimberly Wright and cancer survivor Jim Woodard, also known as Woody. Wright says the McLean County Relay is the second largest such event in the state, and they're trying to keep it that way.
We are very excited to have our event take place at a new venue. The Corn Belters have gifted us the corn crib for our 2018 Relay for Life, which will take place on June 22nd and 23rd. We are still a 24-hour event. We'll go from 2 p.m. on Friday to 2 p.m. on Saturday, and we have lots of activities that will be going on throughout that 24-hour event, including a fun zone with bounce houses, a rock wall, games and activities for the young ones and the young at heart. And we also have our survivor lap, which is our traditional activity that we have on Friday. We will also have local bands that will play throughout the event. We'll have a relay idol contest in the middle of the night and lots of activities for the teams and efforts that they are making through their Relay for Life team fundraising.
The still small wee hours of the morning are really tough. What is the importance of having an all-night, 24 hours solid event when it's punishing?
Sure. Well, we are definitely tired at about 3 a.m., let me tell you. But we have one of the few 24-hour events still in the United States and across the nation and throughout the world. There are 23 different countries that host Relays for Life. They started out as 24-hour events. The meaning behind that is that a cancer patient's journey never stops 24 hours a day. They're fighting 24 hours a day. So for us to stay up for 24 hours, that's the least we can do in honor of those that we've lost to cancer and those that we are fighting to honor and celebrate who have survived cancer.
What do people say about that symbolism of that shared small sacrifice there?
Well, we have many relay teams here in McLean County that are very supportive of the 24-hour experience. We do have teams that don't stay overnight. For some, it just doesn't work for them and their family and their team members. But many of them really look forward to that camp out experience, the 24 hours of fighting and walking and honoring those that we love. And that's important for many of our teams, and that's why we've continued to host the 24-hour experience.
Normal Community West High School student Austin Waller has been named the honorary youth survivor for the Relay for Life of McLean County event this year. Tell us his story, would you?
Austin, he was actually taking a family selfie in October of 2017 when his father noticed a lump. They immediately went to their family nurse practitioner the next day, and he was diagnosed with stage 3 Hodgkin's lymphoma. And he has gone through many months of chemotherapy to fight the disease, and he's doing very well right now.
How does the selfie relate to the discovery of the cancer?
Well, it's interesting that he's, it wasn't something they were expecting. There were no signs, no symptoms, and just by his dad feeling that lump, they thought that was strange. And having that moment where you realize something's not right.
So it was kind of a group hug during the selfie or what?
It really was. Okay. And, through the process of that group hug, his dad noticed the lump and decided to get it checked out. And thankfully, they had that selfie that day.
How's he doing?
He's doing very well. He's going back to school in the fall. He'll be a junior at Normal Community West High School. and he's doing very well. He's back to bowling. He tried to continue all of his activities as much as he could.
That's hard.
And did very, very well, you know, wanting to be a part of regular life for a 15-year-old was very important to him. So he's doing very well.
Last year, you raised nearly $301,000. What are you shooting for this year?
We would love to raise $305,000. We raised a little over $300,000 last year. So we'd like to meet and exceed that goal a little bit. And we have a variety of different ways that we're doing that.
How many teams did you say were there already?
Well, currently we have 50 teams registered, and that doesn't include our Power and Purple candidates.
Also with us is Jim Woodward, or Woody. He's doing the Power in Purple campaign. Woody, tell us a little bit about that, would you?
Yes. First off, very honored to have been selected to participate in this. Besides ourselves, there's so many other people that are working very hard at it. But this Power in Purple campaign is 30 days that we work hard to raise as much money as we can for cancer research. And my other partner, Bill Croft, who works for Snyder Insurance, asked me one day, he said, hey, would you be interested in partnering with me? We're both pretty well-known in the community. We help many, many different charities with the resources that we have connections to. And this was one of the ones that speaks really closely to my heart, since I am a stage 4 survivor of a very rare form of kidney cancer.
How was your treatment experience, and how did the McLean County Relay for Life encourage you along?
Well, I can say this, that most of my treatments were done at the University of Chicago. And 2 years ago, they talked with my wife and myself and said that we're out of options and that we're going to send you home and we're going to get you in contact with a doctor, Dr. Saratnat, and he'll plan hospice and some things like that. Well, of course, anyone who knows me, my logo on my Facebook is Fight Like a Champion. I didn't take that as I'm going to lay down. So I got to meet Dr. Saratnat, who is phenomenal, and he said no. He goes, we're not doing hospice. We're going to try some other avenues. And when you're battling cancer, and I do chemotherapy twice a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, the one thing that I cannot do is stop chemotherapy. And he said, I have so many different kind of chemotherapies up my sleeve that we're going to try. And little did I know, 4 blocks from my house, I would be at Mayo Clinic, MD Anderson, and then now here in Normal, Illinois, getting treated. Just phenomenal. So with Relay for Life and the American Cancer Society, we took part in many different programs that they have in terms of getting me to and from some appointments, which you take for granted when your spouse is working and your friends are working. They were there for me. And I wanted to use this opportunity with my personal story, having a very rare form of kidney cancer, to give back to the community and give back to those who are fighting, who are in worse shape than I am.
So how does the Power in Purple work? You just leverage your connections, or do you go to different venues and tell your story?
I do a lot of public speaking, but this time we chose not to do that. Bill and myself have several different type of campaigns that we have planned all the way up into the Relay for Life celebration. We'll be doing Dunkin' Executive, where we'll be taking a dunk tank around throughout the community and dunking executives, and we have many other programs. We've utilized social media just simply because we have so many friends. Colleen Reynolds, who is a friend of who works here, who's a friend of our campaign, and a friend of Relay for Life, has also given a lot of guidance in terms of different angles on what we can look at to raise money.
The benefit of social media is that you can get your word out in a very efficient way to a lot of people. The downside of social media is everybody's doing it. How are you seeing that play out?
I'm actually seeing that play out very well, to be honest, because not only are we using Facebook, but we're using Snapchat, we're using Twitter, and we're using the old-fashioned way, just calling people, saying, hey, listen, the old-fashioned style of just dialing for dollars also works very well.
You know, we're a very substantial element to the American Cancer Society's funding of cancer research, specifically for kidney cancer. Cancer.org is a great source for people to go and find out, you know, what's happening in the world of research. What is the American Cancer Society funding in the way of research? And just with kidney cancer alone, there are 13 research grants currently going on. We're spending almost $5 million right now currently. And those are updated on a regular basis on cancer.org. And folks understand how the American Cancer Society is helping people right here in our community, not just with the resources and the patient services, but also with the research grants and the progress that we're making in the treatment of cancers of all kinds.
Kimberly Wright and Jim Woodford, or Woody, are with the Relay for Life for McLean County. Since it began in McLean County in 1994, Relay for Life has raised more than $8.3 million in McLean County to fight cancer. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The McLean County Relay for Life is June 22nd and 23rd at the Corn Crib in Normal. Find more information about teams and supporting cancer research at relayforlife.org/McLeanIL. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Charlie Schlenker, Eric Stock, and Ryan Denham. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.